Welcome to Justice Visions, the podcast about everything that is new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org.
Welcome to the second season of Justice Visions. And for those listeners just tuning in for the first time, I am Tine de Strober, and I'm a professor of transitional justice at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. I'm also the project lead of Justice Visions and a regular host of this podcast.
I'm Sangeeta Yogendran. I'm a PhD research fellow at Ghent University and one of the researchers on this great project, examining victim participation in transitional justice processes with a focus on Cambodia.
And Sangeeta, people may actually recognize your voice, right? Because you also do the intro of our podcasts. But today you're here as a co-host. And if I say that you are here as a co-host, and I'm already giving away that we also have another guest. And today that's Sampo Ahoy, who is an expert on the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, and we'll properly introduce her in a bit. But I first wanted to say a few words about what we will be doing this season, because the first season of our podcast has come and gone a lot quicker than we thought, actually. And we got a lot of great feedback from the listeners. One of the most frequent requests that we received was to really talk more about the specific cases in this season.
So this season, we're going to start by zooming in on recent developments in transitional justice contexts around the world.
And we'll start, of course, by putting the spotlight on those cases that we know best, right? Which is the countries that we are studying as part of Justice Visions.
And today in particular, we'll be talking about Cambodia because quite a lot is happening there, actually.
When we first started to work on this episode, it was because one of the defendants in one of the cases, Duke, had died. And we'll say more about that in a minute. But then as we were preparing this episode, actually something else happened, right? And now there are two good reasons to be doing this episode on Cambodia.
One of the only four cases that has ever come before the court actually got dismissed quite recently.
And to understand the importance of both of those things, Sangeeta, I think we first need to take a step back. So give us a short heads up about the Cambodia case.
Great. I'll try to keep this short as possible. So the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, which we'll often refer to as the ECCC.
Or the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, right?
Exactly. It's quite a mouthful. So ECCC or Khmer Rouge Tribunal, it's an international hybrid tribunal, which was set up both by the UN and the Cambodian government to try the most senior leaders and the most responsible members of the Khmer Rouge regime. Now, what's special about it is that this is one of the few international tribunals where victims participate in the proceedings as civil parties.
So civil parties, that means that victims are actually granted procedural rights to participate in their personal capacity. And that's unique, right?
Exactly, that's it. And there have been quite a few challenges and questions regarding how to organize this victim participation because mass crimes make for thousands of victims, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. The crimes perpetrated during the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia, for example, caused the death of nearly 1.7 million people.
And then you read these statistics about how that is actually 1/4 of the population, right?
Which is a shocking number. So in a way, given the widespread scale of the atrocities committed, basically, almost the whole Cambodian population could claim victim status before the ECCC.
But then obviously, not the whole Cambodian population has been involved. And more importantly, also the court has only convicted very few people. And now that's the reason why we're doing this episode. One of them has died.
Correct. Khang Gek Eu, if I'm pronouncing it properly, I hope. Also more commonly referred to as Comrade Duke, was a former senior figure of the Khmer Rouge, and he passed away recently. He was actually serving a life sentence after having been found guilty of war crimes by the ECCC in its very first trial.
So he was actually found guilty.
Exactly. He was also more notoriously known for being in charge of the S21 Security Center in Phnom Penh, Cambodia's capital, where at least 12,000 people were tortured and then killed.
That means only a handful of those survived.
I think it was about 6 or 7 individuals that ended up surviving, which is incredible if you think about it and horrific at the same time. In July 2010, the trial chamber of the ECCC actually convicted him for crimes against humanity and grave breaches of the Geneva Convention and sentenced him to 35 years imprisonment.
So that means that he is one of the few people that actually was sentenced.
One of three, actually. But his sentence was reduced by 5 years. He also received credit for the time that he already spent in detention, both under the authority of the Cambodian military court and the ECCC.
And today we talk about what his death means for victims and for transitional justice processes. But first, the reason, Sangeeta, why you're also with us is because you actually worked on that case, right? And I wanted to ask you to tell us a bit more about that? Because I know you as a researcher, but there you're actually involved as a practitioner. How was that?
It's been a very surreal experience for me to now be working on a Cambodia case study for our project when more than 10 years ago, I was an intern at the ECCC's victims unit, as it was then called. I was still an undergraduate back in law school in Singapore, and the 6 months I spent in that office were truly eye-opening, to say the least. I was actually there for the start of case one, and we at the victims unit were managing the 90-something civil parties who were registered for the first case.
And when you're talking about case one, that's the Duke trial that we're talking about today, right?
There have actually been two cases in total before the ECCC so far. Case one, which we're talking about today, which found Duke guilty for his role in running the Toh Sling prison. And then there's case two. What's worth noting about case two is that because of the huge scale of the crimes covered, this trial was actually split into two parts. So the Deputy Secretary of the Communist Party of Kampuchea was one of the defendants, mm-hmm. and also the former head of state of Democratic Kampuchea, another defendant, were both found guilty of crimes against humanity, grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, and genocide against both the Muslim Cham and Vietnamese communities. Mm-hmm. So case two actually started with four defendants, but proceedings against the Deputy Prime Minister for Foreign Affairs were terminated in 2013 following his death, and the Minister of Social Affairs was found unfit to stand trial due to dementia back in 2011.
So if I'm counting that correctly, there's only two cases where there have been a total of three verdicts.
Exactly. While working at the victims unit, I remember actually organizing, together with my wonderful colleagues, one of whom we'll be speaking to, for the civil parties in that case to visit the tribunal and attend the start of the trial. And as you can imagine, it was a very significant day because it was also during his opening statements that Duke turned to the audience sitting inside the chamber and apologized for the crimes he had committed. Now, I remember that moment elicited a lot of emotional reactions from everyone sitting there, with many civil parties needing to be excused to the sick bay throughout the day because they were experiencing headaches and stomach pains, which I think perhaps were a very physical response to an emotional day.
Actually, what you're saying, Sangeeta, also reminds me of an earlier episode, if you remember one that we did with Rudina Yassini, who also mentioned that it's so difficult to cope with this as a lawyer because you're not really trained for it, right? And you were, in the end, involved as a lawyer, right?
You're completely right, Tina. I was not trained to cope with that in itself. And that was a huge learning experience for me as a practitioner and now as a researcher, and something I've become much more attuned to after that. At the end of that internship, I started working with one of the civil party lawyers, and we worked to put together a case for the Khmer Krom minority. On and off for several years after that, we worked to build a case for this group, who had actually been persecuted by the Khmer Rouge, but they had not been included in the trials up till then. And they were persecuted because they were accused of having Vietnamese heads and Khmer bodies. Mm. So for us as a team, it was actually a really great day many years ago when the submissions were included into case four.
But this case four is the other thing we're talking about with our guest today, because just to recap, you mentioned that there are two cases where there have been verdicts, but then there was also case three and four where there were proceedings or at least attempts to proceed. And now one of those cases got dismissed.
Recently, in August, I believe, the Supreme Court Chamber of the ECCC actually terminated one of the cases with charges against one of the deputy secretaries of the Central Zone. And this was after months of procedural deadlock. So that leaves two remaining cases that are still at the earlier stage of trial. These two remaining cases with charges against additional accused are still pending for both case three and cases four. But they are unfortunately mired in procedural quagmires and unfortunately due to reluctance from national judges, don't seem likely to ever get to the trial stage.
Okay, Sangeeta, I feel that you got me up to speed, and I feel that it's also time to start introducing our guest for this episode, because actually you met our guest while working on case four, right?
Case one, actually, during my time as an intern at the victims unit, that I had the pleasure of becoming friends with my dear colleague and the guest for today's episode, Sampo.
Sampo, welcome to this episode.
Yes, thank you for having me.
We're really happy that you accepted this invitation to join us for this conversation, because you're now in the process of completing your PhD thesis on the topic of, if I'm not mistaken, the treatment of gender crimes and women's contributions in transitional justice and peace building, right?
Yes.
You've got an impressive resume of also working at the very renowned Documentation Center for Cambodia and with the Victims Unit of the ECCC. So my first question, of course, would be if you can tell us a bit more about your involvement in the ECCC and particularly with that case, one that Sangeeta also just told us something about.
I was an outreach facilitator at the victim unit. But at that time, we don't have many people to run the unit. Like Sangeeta have mentioned, she was an intern, but we work together side by side with intern. And also, the unit is located in town, far from the court. The reason that it was in town because it make it easy for survivor to file the application and to connect to the NGO, non-governmental organization who work to support the court proceeding. So my work was like assist survivor to file application as a witness, as civil party or complainant. At that time, we explained them clearly whether they want to be a witness, a civil party. It's a part of the trial. They can join the trial or to be a complainant. Like they only give information to the prosecutor. And we have them to fill the victim information form. We don't have many stuff to run. And then NGO already collect many, many forms and then send to the victim units. And we also collect some form later. We have to work and join hand in hand with NGO and also with the court itself to inform the victims about what happened, what is happening in the court and the progress of the court and give all the information. For example, we give them time to meet with their lawyer and the lawyer explain their rights, how to be a civil party and how they, when they become a civil party, they can be called for testify in the court.
Actually, really interesting, Sampo, and you're really taking me back. You were involved in so much of case one, including, you know, registering the victims, following them to attend the trial. What for you would you say was like the most memorable thing for you from case one?
In my memory, the workload is very, very heavy. I remember that I was so tired. And then my parents didn't see me much at home because I have to spend a lot of time in the province because we have to outreach to many victims who would not be able to come to Phnom Penh to lock their complaint directly in victim unit or the NGO cannot reach them. So we create the civil party like forums and also meeting, and also we go directly to the place that a lot of people would like to lock complain. Remember once the last time before the case 2 deadline, I was in Siem Reap province and one of the lady, she forget to put her shoe on and jump on the motor taxi from her house to the hotel that I and my colleague was working right there to help them assist filling the form. And she told me that it was so emotional. And then she lost all the family member, husband, and all the children. And now she's so lonely, living alone. And at the time that she filed a complaint, from the beginning to the end, she cried emotionally. And at that time, I could not even hold my tear, you know. Oh, la, la. It was so hard working with the victim, but I'm so happy so that I can help them. You know, like to narrate their story, to put everyone know about the hard time, the experience, the difficulty that all the survivors been through those regimes.
In that one story, you've demonstrated how exhausting the work is for the people involved, but also how important it is. Like, I can't imagine this lady, you know, was so certain that she wanted to be part of this process that she literally forgot to wear her shoes. That's cool. And it says so much about how important participation can be for victims involved. And actually, now I'm going to bring your memories back to another day, more than 10 years ago, the ECCC handed down the verdict in the Duke trial. I remember sitting inside the chamber of the courtroom, and the initial reaction among so many people was very mixed. Some were very happy, some were a bit confused about the reduction in sentence. So maybe my question is, what do you think his death means for the whole transitional justice process in Cambodia.
If I were the victim of S21, I feel at least saying that the justice is served. Yes. And as I am a researcher, I feel this is a person who know a lot about the complexity of the history of the Khmer Rouge. And losing though, I think be also losing part of the history of the Khmer Rouge. If you follow the trial, you might know that he won't answer all the questions, I mean, that all the victims would ask. So he didn't reveal all the truth yet. So I think if he would live longer, he might thinking that one day he can reveal the truth. And when I'm talking with some of my foremen, they feel that it didn't make them feel healing or closer, you know, because he didn't tell all the truth that the victim needs.
I find it so interesting what you're saying, Sampo. You're talking about how this passing of Duc affects the victims. And I'm wondering if his passing, do you think it's also going to have an effect on the debate that we hear about, in a way, the legitimacy of the whole ECCC process more broadly, because it's been so contested and that the defendants are so old and they are dying and now yet another defendant has died. Do you feel that this might stall the transitional justice process in Cambodia, or that it might have an effect more on that kind of systemic level as well?
I think right now everyone fatigue about ECCC. Yeah, I'm telling the truth because we can see it's not going forward as much as the international side need to be. The funding is also not really giving a lot to run the ECCC. You know, like the justice process always costs a lot of money. And some people say, oh, we might use all of the money that we pay for ECCC to develop our country, it's better. But I don't think so, because justice cannot be buy.
I can just build on that a bit more. Like, we kind of briefly mentioned what's happening in cases 3 and 4, and that maybe most likely they're not going to proceed to trial. But there are already some civil parties who are admitted to both these cases. So what kind of impact do you think that's going to have on them, regardless of the impact it will have on the tribunal itself, but for the victims who have already been admitted?
Some part of ECCC giving hope for the survivor, and some survivor also disappointed. When I go in for my research, they told me that it's not really what they want, you know, like reparation and all kind of things. It's not really make them happy. They want individual monetary reparation, something that they can dedicate to their loved one individually. But how can we do that? We don't think that only ECCC can play the role, but we have NGO, we have other people take part in the process. ECCC is give people hope at first, and after the process, it's going to shrink, and then people also get disappointed as well. And as you mentioned, the civil party in the case 4, they might be disappointed also because of the case is not going further.
The image that you're painting, in a way, I think it's very realistic. The concerns about victims' expectations being raised and then not being met. I also wanted to ask you, and this is, in a way, in the last season, a question that we also asked all our interviewees, a question about where you are looking now for answers, or in this case, I would almost say, given the constraints that you see politically at the international level in terms of what victims want, I would almost want to ask what your ideal case scenario for the ECCC going forward.
I hope to have more cases to be tried in the tribunal, and also I hope the victim who already filed their complaint in the court, because they want to seek the truth, the justice for their loved one. At first, ECCC give them hope, not only to the survivor, but also they dedicate to the people that they love. And when you upset them, for example, the lady who come to me filed the form, I guess at that night or even a month, she could not sleep well. So this kind of thing, it's hard, you know, like to say that, oh, you now you have the court, so you file a complaint, you will find justice, and then after that, the national ones not go on to make the case forward, and international one, the corruption and the politics around the court. If I were the victims, I also got disappointed. I got upset. For me, I do support ECCC, because without ECCC, we didn't hear what going to happen inside S21. Why those leaders decide to evacuate people from Phnom Penh? Why they decide to kill the intellectual? Why they decide to kill their own people, even to kill their college? It's all about finding the truth and also finding justice at the same time. But to be sure, I do hope that even like the situation in Cambodia right now a little bit tense, but I hope that one day we will work together, we will listen to each other in the courtroom.
I think that's a very beautiful perspective, those two sides that you're underlining. On the one hand, I think that a lot of the critiques and the criticism of the ECCC has often been about its functioning as a hybrid court, but indeed, I think the role it has also had in terms of truth seeking and truth finding and laying bare facts that we would otherwise not have known. I think that's something that quite often gets brushed over in this kind of conceptual definition about, yes, it's a court, so it shouldn't do the work of a truth commission. But what you're saying is, you know, it has brought to light so many things that we otherwise would not have known. And what you're saying also indeed in terms of it being an example of a functioning judicial mechanism, I think that's also an important thing to bear in mind as it is increasingly being contested. And then I think a third point is also an argument that you also hear quite often is, you know, the effect that the ECCC has for the broader region, like what's happening in Myanmar now, to show to people that, you know, accountability will take place at some stage in some form. And then, Sangeeta, I think I'm also returning to you, right? Because this is also Myanmar, for example, is also a case that you've been deeply involved in other contexts. And maybe that's a segue into the question that I wanted to ask you, wanted to complement Samphoa's views with what you think these two phenomena that we've been talking about today, the passing of Duc on the one hand, and then the dismissal of case four on the other hand, what you think the effect of that will be on the ECCC, and how you see the future of the ECCC from your point of view as also a practitioner and researcher.
I think, Sampo, you touched on so many crucial and beautiful points, and I can only echo a lot of them, which is that I think, you know, there's so much of work put into the civil party and victim participation efforts at the ECCC, and you got a lot of buy-in and a lot of investment from individuals who were actually I hope I'm not stereotyping, but in a culture where people are not always so forthcoming about traumatic and personal experiences like this, you actually gave a lot of people the chance to speak up about what happened to them and the opportunity for them to ask questions to find out the truth about what happened to their loved ones. And I think that truth-telling function of the ECCC cannot easily be replaced and should not be replaced, because the tribunal has had so many functions. And I think more importantly, you know, a lot of victim expectations were set, and it would be a shame if as a result of either defendants passing away or, you know, procedural issues before the tribunal, meaning that cases cannot go ahead, you are then going to cause a lot of victims to be so disappointed, especially the ones that have already invested their time and efforts into this. I'm thinking about some of the people we spoke to 10 years ago when we were trying to build a case, and how much excitement and enthusiasm there was when we could finally go back and say, look, after years of fighting and advocating for your cause, we've now included you into one of the trials. And then to have the trial not even proceed, I can completely understand if victims would be very disappointed. And the bigger loss is that victims are then disappointed in the whole participation process altogether. And Tina, like you mentioned, I think the ECCC is an example, not just for other international hybrid tribunals, but more importantly for Asia or Southeast Asia, if I can narrow it down even more. There's a lot of need for accountability, I would say, in certain situations in the Asian context, Myanmar being one of them, where the the ECCC could serve as a very good example. And I would hope that, you know, because of these developments, you don't take away from the learning process, not just within Cambodia, but for a much wider region.
Yes, that's a beautiful perspective. And I think what you both also show is that it's very clear that developments like the ones we've been talking about today, that they have a profound impact on victims and on the transitional justice process, but also in a way that we shouldn't despair, because you're both showing that this process goes on in various forms and shapes. And no matter the kind of setbacks that we're facing, people always find a way to work around and to push forward in their struggle for more justice. And I think that's actually also related. As we are coming to the end of this episode, I want to take this as a stepping stone to also link this to our next episode, because we're moving all the way, I think, more or less to the other side of the globe there, but also looking at a case where current events are actually very much linked to the transitional justice process. And that will actually be this next episode on constitutional developments in Chile, where we will be talking to Marit Dahan. It sounds very different, but we'll definitely try to link it back to this conversation. So at this point, I just want to thank you both, Sangeeta and Sampoa, for sharing these insights. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing this evolve further.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council. The podcast is produced by Wederik de Backer. You heard the voices of Tina de Strupper, the Justice Visions researchers, and our guests.